Good afternoon. Thank you for joining us on Holy Family Radio for Faith and Reason, where we connect culture and ideas to the daily lives of Catholics. I'm Dr. John Pinero, Associate Professor of History and Director of Catholic Studies at Aquinas College in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Today we're going to be speaking with Monica Miller. Dr. Miller is the Director of Citizens for a Pro-Life Society, an activist pro-life group she founded in 1986. She's also an Associate Professor of Sacred Theology at Madonna University. Dr. Miller is nationally known as a pro-life leader, a pioneer and veteran of pro-life activism dating back to 1976. She also founded Citizens for a Pro-Life Society. In addition to that leadership, is her role at Madonna University. Monica and her husband Edmund have three children, and she is the author not only of Abandon, The Untold Story of the Abortion Wars, which was published in 2012 by St. Benedict Press, and we'll be talking about that book today. That's her newest book. She's also the author of a number of books, among which are Sexuality and Authority in the Catholic Church, a topic that doesn't seem to go away, so I think we'll talk about all those today, I hope. Welcome to the show, Monica.
Thank you. It's just great to be with you.
I'm glad to have you on the show. We're really looking forward to this interview, and I guess I get started by saying that you have an impressive amount of writing to your credit, and your newest book on abortion, that Abandon, looks fascinating. Man, is that getting great reviews, and especially the kind words that Dinesh D'Souza had to write about it, calling it the best book ever written on abortion.
Yeah, that's high praise, and I'm so grateful to him.
Yeah, so... I hope our listeners check out that book. But first, I would like to talk about your book, Sexuality and Authority in the Catholic Church, and not just about the book, but really about those concepts.
Yeah.
Maybe we should ask, and this is a topic that's near and dear to me as someone who reverted to my Catholic faith decades ago when I was a young man in my early 20s in college. And it was the question of authority, actually, that drew me to the church. The more I studied and studied and studied, I thought this was when I thought the Episcopal Church was imploding in the late 80s and early 90s, but I hadn't really seen anything yet. And but I thought it was, and I thought, here's the problem. What's the authority? And if Scripture's the authority, then every man's his own authority in the name of Scripture being the authority. And it was really the authority question. So I guess I'd start in relation to the topic of sexuality and authority. What is authority, and how is it related to the subject of sexuality?
Well, my book, Sexuality and Authority in the Catholic Church, when all is said and done, it is a theological critique or analysis of ecclesial authority. What is authority in the church? And then, building on that idea, how is authority differentiated between men and women? And then it gets us into the issue, of course, of the ordained priesthood on the one side, hierarchical authority on the one side, if you will. And then the accusation or the difficulty or the criticism or whatever word you want to put at it there comes in when, if authority is simply hierarchical authority, it's the authority of the Pope and the bishops and the priests, well, it looks like then that women, since they cannot be priests, are somehow left out in the cold, right?
Right.
That they're disenfranchised from participation in the authority of the church. And so I'm examining that whole problem, so to speak. But
and whether they know it or not, I guess most, it seems many people, the critics of the structure of the Catholic Church, are coming from this Marxist vantage point that sees everything as a power relationship.
Well, not only that, but if justice is going to be done, we have to make everything the same.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, the first chapter of my book is a full analysis of feminist theology, And so if somebody wants to get acquainted with feminist theology and they don't want to read a whole book on the subject, they could just read the first chapter of my book, and they'll get pretty much the full blast of whatever it is they need to know. But let me backtrack just a little bit, because I think it's important to clarify what we're talking about when we talk about authority. Because I think that there is a huge misunderstanding, and there's a huge misunderstanding among people who oppose the church. But this misunderstanding is still something that you will find among extremely devout Catholics as well. And that is the idea that authority means power, that those two things are synonymous. And I really kind of correct what I think is a mistaken idea there. Power is a quantifiable strength. It's a force that is put to use in order to move or to propel a certain agenda or a certain program or a certain policy or the enforcement of a certain rule. And it's not always the same thing as authority. Legitimate authority, power sometimes can be corrupted. Power can be opposed because it doesn't legitimately reflect or enhance human dignity and human rights. And quantifiable strength. Who has the bigger muscles? Who has the bigger army? Who has the most money? Those are all the people that will be in power, and then we got to listen to them, right? Really, authority, if we want to have a proper theological view, authority, especially if we're looking at the authority of God, and if people think that what it means for God to be almighty, right? Even in the creed, we profess our faith in a God the Father, the Almighty, right? But what does that really mean? God has authority because he gives life. And even the word authority itself comes out of the Latin for the word auctor, meaning to be the source, to be the origin of something. So this is a creative dynamic that we're looking at here. Authority then really is the ability to give life, and then the responsibilities and the duty that are connected to life-giving, so that whatever is brought to life may be brought to its fulfillment. And that's authority. And that's why authority should be obeyed, because obedience to legitimate authority enhances your life, gives you more life, expands your life. We don't just obey God, for example, because we're afraid of violating his will. Obedience, ultimately, to God is a response of love to the one who is the ultimate life giver. Why should children obey their parents? Because they're afraid that if they don't obey their parents, they're going to get punished, and so it's just rewards and penalties, and that's the way that we're going to regulate our lives. There's very little freedom in that kind of a model of authority. Children obey their parents because the authority of the parent is designed to direct the child to a fuller, more satisfying life. And so authority ultimately is a life-giving, and if you want to use the word power, that's fine, but it's a life-giving power. And that's what makes it legitimate, and legitimate authority, an authority that should rightly be obeyed. So I kind of have to readjust our thinking about that. Mm-hmm. And then we get into the whole area. Human sexuality, and I'm sure, John, you've probably noticed, that's an area in which we're really pretty much whacked out. our modern culture, honestly, is in a crisis on the meaning of masculinity and femininity.
Yes, we had recently Elizabeth Kelly on the program from the University of St. Thomas, and she was she was going down the list of new genders that are being created, at least on forums,
well,
and they keep coming this kind of confusion like that, and keep adding to the list. She spoke of Germany and other places, but
absolutely right. So the Catholic Church has a very beautiful and at the same time a very committed specific doctrine on the meaning of masculinity and femininity. To be male and to be female are God-given gifts, and they are constitutive of what it means to be human. And so these are not arbitrary, random, merely biological roles. And my argument is that going all the way back to the book of Genesis, when God makes the human race male and female, again, these are not just biological, functional roles played out by men and women, in order to make babies. Mm-hmm. Okay, this is not just biology for the sake of reproduction. And that's the only value that being either male or female has. Really, masculinity and femininity are sacred symbols. These are the primary symbols, in fact, I would argue, and that's what I do argue in my book. Masculinity and femininity, being male or female, are the primary sacramental signs by which the very covenant of redemption itself is composed. And these sacramental signs are given to us in creation they have a prophetic value. They have a transcendent value. And I use that term again, sacramental value. What is it that being either male or female, and then ultimately the unity, the one flesh unity between men and women, this is a sacred sign, and even St. Paul says so in chapter 5 of his letter to the Ephesians. The unity, the one flesh unity between the original couple from the beginning is a sign of a great mystery, namely what? The unity between Jesus and the church. And so these are not symbols or signs that we can, based on some sort of social agenda or philosophical concept or whatever you want, these are not signs that we can dismantle. These are not signs that we can rearrange. These are not signs that we can empty of their value and then fill them with something else. Because when we do that, we are really tampering with a God-designed language. The language that speaks the covenant between God and his people. And I think we just have to, you know, begin to really understand that in a much more profound way. I mean, when all is said and done, the covenant of redemption itself is a marriage. It is the marriage. That means it's not irrelevant to the economy of redemption that Jesus Christ is male. His masculinity has a redemptive meaning. That he calls himself bridegroom is not just poetic language. He's actually saying something about what it means for him to be the Savior. And of course, if we're talking about masculinity and femininity, or males and females, to be male or to be female, these are relational realities. It means that we are in relation. And so when Christ declares himself to be the bridegroom to his church, he's saying what? He's saying he is in relation to his body, his bride, his people. So that means that the covenant of redemption is not just Jesus all by himself, but Jesus in relation to his people, and his people, the church, and this goes all the way back to the New Testament writings, all the way through the fathers of the church, and up to the very present moment. The church is a female. The church is feminine. The church is understood as a bride and mother, in relationship to God. And so my argument is, if that's true, and this is not just a poetic way of talking, just mere symbolic language, that could be, you know, we could substitute the language with something else and it would be just the same thing. No. My argument is that if Christ's masculinity is actually constitutive of what it means for him to be Savior to his people, then that means that his church, women are the primary symbol and the primary reality of what the church is in relationship to Christ. And this even, we can even see this in the life of Mary, the mother of God, where the church as bride and mother is founded on a Marian model. And so sexuality and authority in the Catholic Church, more than anything else, wants to explain the meaning of feminine authority, because that's where most of the work needs to be done. And in fact, our current Holy Father, Pope Francis, has even called for a deeper thinking on the subject of the role of women in the church. Well,
so that is what,
like,
that
okay,
is what
well,
he
guess
meant.
What? I've done a whole lot of work already. I've written two whole books on this subject, sexuality and authority in the Catholic Church, and then I wrote a smaller, I guess you might say, more reader-friendly version of it, which was simply the authority of women in the Catholic Church. And I'm looking to get this other book, The Authority of Women in the Catholic Church, reprinted right now as we speak. But sexuality and authority in the Catholic Church is still in print, and it's still available. People can easily get it just by going on Amazon, Amazon.com, and get a copy of it.
So there's confusion arising from all kinds of sources in the modern world, but I think this idea of equality meaning exact sameness, and that,
right,
the lack of the complementarity we find in the Catholic tradition on this, gets us into one of probably the biggest issues then for those who do not know or do not know well the Catholic teaching and the grounding, as you said, going through Scripture, through the early fathers, on up to the present day, through John Paul II and his letter to women. We find this in lots of sources about the all-male priesthood and the reasons,
right,
for that. So if I'm among our listeners, there's going to be Catholics and non-Catholics, and many people react to that, and all they see is, well, can I be all I can be? Can I do what I want to do? Aren't I free? Maybe they think of the Scripture that says neither Jew nor Greek, male nor female.
Right, right. It's Galatians chapter 3, verse 12.
So,
yeah.
So the Church teaches that women cannot be priests. There are no priestesses in the Catholic Church.
Right.
There's sources for that where we can direct people, but could you explain the connection from that of the importance of Jesus Christ's maleness going into the priesthood then?
Absolutely. If the gender of Jesus as male has a redemptive value, then the church has to insist, if that's the case, then the sacrament that makes him present, the sacrament that makes the love of the bridegroom present to his people, that sacrament has to be also male, the male person. What is a priest? A priest is in persona Christi. And not in persona Christi simply according to Jesus' mind or Jesus' love or Jesus' spirit or his teaching or, you know, whatever disembodied reality you want to affirm. Christ became male to exemplify the love of the bridegroom for his people. And that is really what is celebrated in the Eucharist. The Eucharist is a nuptial ceremony in which the covenant between Christ and his people is celebrated, affirmed, and made present in this world. And so the symbols by the symbols, it's, you know, sounds like it's something trivial, but it's not. The symbols by which we worship have to properly express the truth about the covenant of redemption. And so, indeed, I would argue it would be incoherent for a woman to stand in the place of Christ as he has accomplished his saving work as bridegroom to his church. What has to be cultivated is a far, far deeper appreciation for the church as female, and then how it is that women, and in particular baptized women, exemplify and make real in time and space and history that truth about the church in relationship to Jesus. And those are that is what we celebrate in the Eucharist, this nuptial banquet. And so it matters that shall we say the gender roles or the symbols that are embedded, imprinted on human nature, as human nature is male or female. So these are sacred transcendent signs by which the church understands and celebrates and makes present the covenant between God and his people. So that's why the church insists that only men can be ordained, because it is what it is about Jesus that they are making present to the church. And the church has no power. It has no ability to change that truth. It can only abide by it. It can only live that mystery. It cannot change that mystery. And you know, this, you know, it sounds like we're in the middle of the debate or whatever, but this is basically a settled issue.
Well, this was pronounced settled many times, but particularly when John Paul II was Pope, I recall saying, "Look, this is, you know, the topic's kind of closed." Now, people still talk about it. There's confusion about it, but it is a settled issue. And from what I hear you say, this is not only rooted then, as most Catholics know, in the person of Jesus Christ and the fact that he was physically on this earth in bodily form, but also in ecclesiology. That side is what we need to take a good look at it.
Yeah.
And I know I was really happy to see in the most recent translation, English translation of the Roman Missal, that we're referring to the Church of She again. Like those little things like that matter. Particularly in a country where there's much confusion. If we go from it to she, that's really big.
And absolutely.
I don't know if you've ever suffered through a liturgy with gender-neutral language. I have, and I lose all imagery, and somehow, you know, we may be reading a psalm that's been neutered, and you know it's a psalm referring to Christ, but now you can't really tell. You're not sure.
Yeah, we can't call God he, and so every time the word he is, you know, comes up in a prayer or in a psalm or in a hymn, it gets converted to God, 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 and there's no he.
It's so clunky and uncomfortable, just the use of the language way.
It's such a contrivance. It drives me up a wall, but... talking about feminist theology, I think some people really need to know. I think this is something that is largely unknown about feminist theology. Feminist theology ultimately does not believe in the priesthood. The goal of feminist theology is not to get women ordained. That is the goal. That is not the goal. That may be the short term goal, but ultimately, the goal is to dismantle the priesthood. No priesthood of any kind. And this is because of a very basic principle, without which there really would be no feminist theology. They are opposed to any kind of distinctions within the church itself. And they would not call the church she, so itself. There should be no class, there should be no distinctions of any kind. Their dictum really is, if you could kind of, you know, boil it down to a formula, the formula goes something like this. inequality equals injustice. Inequality, or difference, really the word I should have there is difference equals injustice. What then is the solution? Sameness equals justice. And they're very opposed to any kind of theological idea that there would be a class or a group of certain persons within the church who would actually have an ability or a power that is not shared by everyone. And so it's not to get women into the priesthood, because that all really what all that is just women buying into the hierarchical order, which they claim is a part of patriarchy. It's part of the androcentric, male-ordered power structure. And so that would be a problem if it's just that we want to get women ordained. The problem would still exist. The hierarchical order of the church and the sacramental priesthood that says that there is a class within the church that has a power and an ability that is not shared by everyone else. Namely what? To confect the Eucharist and to make Jesus ontologically, physically, truly present, and not everybody has that power, right? I don't have it, and if you're not ordained, you don't have it. So this is unjust, right? I mean, come on, that's totally unjust. So what's the goal is to eliminate the priesthood altogether, and then the Eucharist becomes a celebration not of the unique Jesus, because not even Jesus can be unique, but really it is a celebration of the faith of the people that is shared by everyone, and that's the feminist church, the egalitarian church without distinctions.
Now, would you say, though, at least among theologians, that idea is dying and fading away? That's the remnant of, for lack of a better term, right now, sort of baby boomer era theology, or is that growing?
I would say it is an era that I think it's definitely reached its peak.
Okay, because I don't see it in the students who come to Aquinas College. That is, they. You know, to a student, they're not concerned, and I've talked about this with our new chaplain, Father Stan Drunkowski, and we had a chat about this, and during his interview process, he was asking me what the students were like, where are they at spiritually, that kind of thing, and I said they're just not concerned with the issues of the last generation, and I use the term power relationships. I said they want to engage in acts of charity. They want to go to adoration. They want to kneel during the liturgy. There's a lot of things they want to do, but they mostly revolve around a relationship with Jesus Christ and a prayer life and devotions, and especially acts of service and charity that our students are very involved in. But when talking about the role of women in the church, maybe it's the long tutelage under John Paul II and Benedict for these students, but it seems to be barely on their radar.
I would agree with you, John. I think though there still remains among the rank and file Catholic, maybe there is a kind of a acceptance on a certain level that women are not going to get ordained. But I don't think that they understand why.
Okay, and that's kind of the goal of our show here. That is, you know, connecting the riches of the Catholic intellectual tradition to daily life. We want Catholics to know why they believe what they believe, and if they act in a particular way, and it actually is undergirded with some serious intellectual tradition. We'd like them to know that to deepen that.
Yeah, and I think this is where the work needs to be done. I think probably the center of the storm has passed in terms of the dissent, but I still think a lot of work has to be done in the theological appreciation for why the church has this position. I think listeners would be interested to access John Paul II's 1994 document, it's Ordinatio Sacerdotalis, that's the Latin, of course, but where he settled the issue. In fact, I'd like to read, it's very short, the statement towards the end of the, and this thing is really short. I mean, this is like a two-page document, so it's not like, you know, access a document, you're going to have to read it for an hour.
Oh, I could use that in class if it's
wherefore,
2 pages. That's great.
Wherefore, in order that all doubt may be removed regarding a matter of great importance, a matter which pertains to the Church's divine constitution itself, in virtue of my ministry of confirming the brethren, I declare that the Church has no authority whatsoever to confer priestly ordination on women, and that this judgment is to be definitively held by all the Church's faithful. So with that, really, there's no going back. In fact, there was a, what's called a dubium on the part of some of the American bishops. A dubium means a question. A question that was sent to the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith regarding the status of that statement. How is it to be regarded? And Ratzinger, then, of course, before he was Pope, responded that it is infallible teaching. So this is not going to change. I'm going to bet the mortgage. This is not happening. And so the women are not going to get ordained in the Roman Catholic Church. Now, will there be splinter groups? Will there be dissenters? Will there be confusion? Will there be ignorance? Of course, and that's unfortunately that still remains with us. But this is settled doctrine.
Well, and it has always been thus over one issue or another within the Church, including the early years of the Church. If it wasn't over this issue, it was over some Gnostic heresy or another,
right,
or the person of Jesus. And it's easy to forget if one looks back at the so-called golden era of American Catholicism, in particular in the 40s and 50s, that the Church has been riven with dissenters since it was established, really. I mean, even within,
right,
the disciples, right? There was Judas, and so we have to always keep it constant conversion and keep building up the body of Christ. And thankfully, we have such a rich tradition in the Catholic Church. The learning, everything we can draw on from books like yours to going back to the early fathers of the Church. I would like to segue into discussion of some of your other work. When you mentioned the person of Mary earlier, and when I think of Mary, I think of the things you were mentioning, but I also always think of her yes, you know, her let it be,
right,
done to me according to your will, her acceptance of the life that was within her as the Mother of God.
Mm-hmm.
And so your newest book is on abortion. And in,
yes,
fact, the title is Abandoned, but the subtitle is the Untold Story of the Abortion Wars. And I think a lot of our listeners would be very interested in that. There are many Catholics, and I'd have to count myself among them, where I do a lot within the Church and in my capacity at Aquinas College and at my parish, etc. But some feel drawn to going into the trenches of that particular fight, and some aren't in it. And, you know, I can't say I've been in it as in, you know, I'm not a sidewalk counselor. I wouldn't know, maybe I wouldn't know what to say.
Mm-hmm.
And the things in your book are startling. They're interesting. They're sad. There's just so many kinds of stories in there that I think are eye-opening to people like me who are, of course, pro-life and vote that way and work for it and support adoption, etc., but haven't been in the fight the way you've quite famously have.
Mm. Well, Abandoned, the Untold Story of the Abortion Wars, is, well, it's a couple of different things. First of all, it is a history, a narrative history, basically the first 19 to 20 years of pro-life activism. And what do I mean by that? The book begins in 1976, and takes the reader through the year of 1994. And this is kind of a lost history. I mean, there are people who were absolutely fundamental in building the pro-life movement. And the younger, our younger, you know, pro-lifers don't even know who they are. If I were to mention Jack Wilkie or Joan Andrews or even Father Paul Marx, people don't even know who they are. And this, of course, is you know, really unacceptable. You know, these are the people who devoted their lives to the pro-life struggle in the early days of legalized abortion, and so they're part of this 40-year battle that we've been involved with. So I think it's very important that the pro-life movement write their own history, write its own history, because the analogy that I give is, how impoverished would the record be if only outsiders wrote about the abolitionist movement? If the histories about the, you know, the struggle to free the slaves in the 18th and 19th century, if that history is only written by the journalists or the historians or whoever, but there was no record of the people who are actually you know, on the ground, in the trenches, doing the work, and what it meant for them to be involved in freeing the slaves. Again, it would be a huge impoverishment. Mm-hmm. I feel now we are 40 years into this battle for the right to life, and we have to chronicle and preserve this historical moment. And we have to do it from our perspective, what it meant for us to do what we did, why we did it, how we did it, how we felt about it when we did it, is to preserve a very important narrative history. So Abandon the Untold Story of the Abortion Wars does that. On the other hand, I really want to tell the truth. I mean, I give a lot of talks about my book, and you know, people will ask me, why did I write it? Well, it sounds like a... you know, kind of a simplistic response, but the response really is to tell the truth. And what do I mean by that? As a pro-life activist, I have had very unique, almost unbelievable experiences in my in the work that I've done to try and save unborn children from abortion. And so this book will take the reader really down into the trenches with us as we did this work. And I want to break open the essence of the abortion tragedy in a way that hasn't been done, that this is not just a philosophical debate, it's not a political problem, it's not even a social problem. What really is it? What is it? What is at stake when we talk about the killing of innocent unborn children? And so I'm really hoping to pronounce some themes having to do with the nature of human communion, the problem of isolation and alienation that abortion ultimately represents. And the book is divided into three parts as a narrative history. And while it is autobiographical, I don't consider this to be a memoir. It just so happens that I write it in first person and so on. But okay. Really, I'm hoping when somebody reads the book that it's the unborn child who's the main character of this story. And the book, as I say, divided into three parts. The first part focusing on my time in Chicago when I was a graduate student, and I was first getting involved in sidewalk counseling and then in the clinic sit-ins, that's what we called them back in the early days, that we did these sit-ins at abortion clinics in Chicago, what it meant for us to go to court, the kinds of challenges that we faced from the opposition when we went to court in our attempts to advocate and to promote the humanity of the unborn child. Then it moves into a more intense activity regarding rescues at abortion clinics, the rise of the rescue movement, and the rescues that we did in particular in Milwaukee when I was also a graduate student studying for my PhD. I was a student at Marquette. And getting arrested, going to court, the court trials that we had, and the jail time that we served as a consequence of defending the unborn. And then overlapping that episode with the rescues at clinics was a very unique experience of the actual retrievals of the aborted children from trash containers, both in 1987 and then again in 1988. And this, really, when I'm talking about the untold story of the abortion wars, this is the most untold story. The secret, it really is a kind of secret, a secret that is kept by the abortion industry itself regarding what are they doing with the bodies? Where do you put 55 million exterminated people? I mean, because that's what we're dealing with now after 40 years of legalized abortion. Well, some of them were found literally in the trash dumpsters behind abortion clinics. I talk about the episode of the pathology lab in Northbrook, Illinois, and when in 1988 we retrieved over 5,000 bodies of aborted babies from the loading dock of that pathology lab. What did that mean for us? And the photography that we did of, by the way, if people want to take a look at our galleries, I think we have the most spectacular, if not, of course, disturbing, but just spectacular photography of abortion victim, of abortion victims. And people can take a look at imagesofabortion.com, all one word, of course, imagesofabortion.com. The website is dedicated exclusively to abortion victim photos and video, which is out there for public use. I mean, we don't require, any kind of remuneration necessarily or even credit. I mean, we ask for it, but it's not like it's a requirement. We're just hoping that people will access this photography and make use of it in their pro-life work. But that all goes back to the finding of these babies back in 1987 and 1988. And then again, the last time was in 2010, so the most recent finding and the photography that I did was in the year 2010, now, and that had to do with babies here in Michigan. But
was this also done, the finding of these aborted babies, was this also done to give them proper burials as well?
The primary purpose for retrieving them was to bury them.
Okay, and so with the photographs, I know even within the pro-life movement, the images, as you said, of course they're disturbing, and I've seen them myself. What do you hope to evoke in somebody? I know some in the pro-life movement would say, well, let's show. Why not show the living children within the womb to communicate that this indeed is a life, and to make people realize that? So that's what's kicking around in there and moving, and you see the little hands with the new sonograms and now the three-dimensional technology. Mm-hmm. Why use dead bodies?
Well, I think for a number of really good reasons. Number one, there's absolutely no substitution for the photograph of a victim of injustice. And looking at the photos of intact unborn children, I'm all in favor of that, of course. That is part of our work. We have to always do that. But when we understand what it is that an unborn child suffers in the abortion procedure that happens 3,500 times in surgical abortions per day in America, with the sanction of law, under a law that says that they are non-persons, which is already a problem. Even if nobody ever dies, that's already a problem. I think it's important for people to be engaged with that tragedy. And it's the tragedy that calls us to actually do something about it. When you see the photo of an abortion victim, it's that victim that is calling you to be their voice and to speak for that child. And there is simply no social justice movement that has not, on some level, relied on images. We can talk about civil rights and slavery and the Nazi Holocaust, even the use of chemical weapons in a more recent example in Syria, with the open graves, the mass graves with children lined up one after another, like cordwood in these graves. We see the inhumanity of man, and that is the thing that calls us to do something about it. I feel very strongly that the victims of abortion should not remain invisible. These are real people who lived once and who were unjustly put to death, and they have a right to speak their truth, and it's the photos that allow them to do that. I've written had an article published in the New Oxford Review. It really is probably the most comprehensive article ever written on the subject of abortion victim photography and the role that these images play in pro-life work. And it's on our website, so if people want to read it, and it's right on the homepage. Just go to prolifesociety.com. Again, it's all one word, no hyphens or anything, prolifesociety.com, and they can access a copy of that article on our homepage. And it'll look exactly the way it looks when the New Oxford Review had it on their website. So it'll have the masthead and all the graphics that go with it. Again, I just don't think there's any substitute for the truth that these photos, make available, and people need to, I think, have their consciences awakened to the real tragedy of what happens to aborted babies, under this unjust law in the United States of America.
And in your article, I recall you saying that you're calling it essential to the movement, not tangential, but really. Really essential to the movement,
right? And I am kind of on a bit of a crusade. I've given the matter of the use of these images in pro-life work a lot of thought, and in fact, I've even kind of put together a PowerPoint. I've given a couple of presentations on this subject fairly recently, and I really urge that pro-lifers do not refer to these photos as graphic images, this catch-all kind of a term, graphic images. I think that is deficient terminology. These are not just graphic images. And by the way, not every abortion photo is graphic. There is a spectrum of exceptionally graphic on one side and a lot less graphic on the other side. And I will argue, too, that not every photo of an aborted baby is a good photo. I think that there should be some critical thinking involved in the kinds of photos that we're selecting for people to look at. So I've done a lot of thinking on it, but we should call them abortion victim photos, because that's what they really are. They're not just graphic images. Because when you say graphic images, what are you really telling somebody? That they're going to see a photo that has a lot of blood and guts and has an ick factor and will be, the first thing is it's just a disturbing photo of something gruesome and grotesque. But is that really what the photo is about?
And it implies that it will repulse them and not...
Repel, right. Yeah. The photo has a repulsive element in it, and that's its primary characteristic. I think that's wrong. The primary characteristic of a good abortion photo is the baby, the victim. And so that's why I'm really urging that we shift our language and forevermore refer to these pictures, whether they're good ones or bad ones, but nonetheless, that we refer to them as abortion victim photos, or even just abortion photos, but not. But I like that word victim because it already gives a value. It provides the philosophy that you want to express, that some injustice happened here, and that this is a photo of that victim, and that's exactly what abortion victim photo says, that graphic image or graphic images doesn't say.
Well, in our last 5 minutes here, then, what I'd like to refer to a statement you made in that New Oxford Review article. You said, I've been accused, I think this was in the article, unless it was in the book, but, you know, I've been accused of being obsessed with this issue. You're darn right. You're darn right I am. Or
actually, that was in my commentary regarding Pope Francis.
Oh, well, that's what I wanted to ask you about.
Yeah,
about if you could share that with our...
Gave that interview to America Magazine, and then, of course, it just exploded all over the place. Too obsessed with abortion, gay rights, and contraception, and so on. So, there was that. But, I think that, I don't think the Pope certainly didn't mean to belittle or to say that this wasn't an important issue. I totally understand that. I'm really concerned about the way that not only what he said, but also the exploitation that came about as a consequence of that interview. And I think, if somebody wanted to say you shouldn't be obsessed about abortion, to me that's like telling Oskar Schindler that he shouldn't have been obsessed about the Nazi Holocaust. I mean, this is something that a person should rightly be obsessed about. Obsessed in the proper way of trying to end a terrible injustice that has affected tens of millions of innocent human beings all over the world. And this is something that should take over your life. It should become part of who you are to do pro-life work and to be an advocate for these innocent victims. This is a legitimate apostolate that can dominate who you are and what you are as a Catholic. So that's kind of how I see it.
Well, thank you for that. This is Dr. Pinero. You've been listening to Faith and Reason, and we've been talking with Dr. Monica Miller for about the last hour about her work and her recent history that she's written, Abandon, the Untold Story of the Abortion Wars, about the history of the fight against abortion and the...
And, John, if people want to get the book, they can simply go to St. Benedict Press. That's the publisher, great Catholic publisher, St.
Yes.
Benedict Press, or just go on Amazon. It's easily available there as well.
You're very good. I was going to get to that, but I'm glad you're pointing them to that book as well as the other book we were speaking of on sexuality and authority in the church. Now, you said that's still available, but hoping it comes out in a new edition. Is that correct?
Well, it's the other book, The Authority of Women in the Catholic Church, that I'm working on getting reprinted. But Sexuality
Great.
And Authority in the Catholic Church is available. The easiest way to get it is simply to go to Amazon.com.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being on the show, and I want to thank you very much for writing this book, Abandoned. As a historian, I agree with you about people in these movements, and especially this one, need to write their own history before people write it for them, and they will write it for them, and they have already. And
right.
I think you've given us something very valuable. Thank you.
Thank you, and God bless you. It's been my pleasure.
Thanks. Goodbye.
You've been listening to Faith and Reason with your host, Dr. John Pinero, on Holy Family Radio. If you'd like to listen to this program again or share it with a friend, audio copies are available online at holyfamilyradio.net. Dr. John Pinero is Associate Professor of History and Director of Catholic Studies at Aquinas College in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Faith and Reason is brought to you by Holy Family Radio. I'm your program producer, Michael Fiorenzo. Join us next time as we connect the riches of the Catholic intellectual tradition to daily life. Thanks for listening.